Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Alison Bronowski is visiting fellow in the Faculty of Asian Studies at the Australian National University, a former diplomat. She's the author of several books, some of which she's addressed to the Institute, including The Yellow Lady, Australian Impressions of Asia, About Face, Asian Accounts of Australia, Howard's War, and she's co-author of The Third Try, Can the United Nations Work? And Ellen DuPont is currently acting Chief Executive Officer of the United States Study Centre of the University of Sydney, but his other position is Director of the Centre for International Security Studies at the University of Sydney. And of course, Professor DuPont is a well-known commentator and a published author. But tonight it's Alison Bronowski's book, Allied and the Dictator. Janet Grundy's got some copies on the back. So we'll start off with Alison Bronowski, then we'll hear from Ellen DuPont and have our question discussion. Alison, please.
Good evening. May I thank Gerard and Anne Henderson for once again opening this forum to the discussion of controversial ideas and at a highly appropriate time. As we approach this election, perhaps I think the most important for many years, a question for voters in 2007 is one that rarely arises at elections, and it's a cow of such holiness that it's usually avoided in polite conversation: the Australia-United States alliance. In fact, some people have reacted to my little book on the subject as if I was a bomb-throwing traitor to Australia, or worse, to America. But all it does, really, is ask whether the alliance delivers security, or whether it endangers Australia more than it protects us, or whether we do for it what it's not in Australia's interest to do. Alan DuPont has distinguished himself by departing from the conventional ways of considering Australia's security. Sharing this platform with him gives me an opportunity, I think, to do the same. So, rather than going over what's in my book, which you can read for yourselves, I'd like to propose for your consideration this evening whether Australia has become a more militaristic country, and to ask what the implications are of that for our security. Some of our regular columnists, who you read every morning, seem not to know why, apart from being perversely bored, a majority of Australian survey respondents now seem to want a change of government. The Prime Minister too now seems perplexed about what motivates Australian voters. He has said that meeting people is the best part of the job that he's been doing for three decades. So he's very well placed, you'd think, to know what most Australians think. And that's something he quite often tells us about. Yet he and the Foreign Minister can confidently tell us what is in the minds of all Islamist fundamentalists, without having met any terrorists, as far as I know. Our leaders often explain that it's the terrorists' perverted interpretation of Islam and their hatred of who we are, not of anything that we've done, that motivates them to attack us. Might some part of the answer that they don't give to both questions be, it's Iraq, stupid? The government counters this, of course, by saying there were terrorist plots to attack Australia before we went to war in Iraq, certainly. And a longer and more nuanced explanation might notice that the first of many al-Qaeda attacks was against US forces going into Somalia in 1992. Later targets in other countries included America's friends and allies. Terrorism has a long history as a form of asymmetric warfare, like resistance and guerrilla movements, that's waged against more powerful occupying and invading forces. So the United States and its supporters, as al-Qaeda spokespeople have often explained, make themselves targets by invading and occupying other countries, Islamic countries usually. In mid-2003, after President Bush had declared mission accomplished in Iraq, Mr. Howard said that most Australians had moved on from the war. Well, no, unfortunately, and the consequences of what's now called the Long War are still emerging. Saddam Hussein fell indeed, but the war has since contributed to the undoing of a German chancellor and the prime ministers of Spain, Britain, and Japan. No leader has successfully invaded another country since Bismarck in 1870, and I owe that to Professor Robert O'Neill. And Iraq is unlikely to be the exception. Even if Iraq's effects on the elections in Australia are as small as our troop contribution, the scale of the United States' involvement there is already affecting the American economy and society, and with that, the standing of the United States and its allies in the world. Waging war on terror, as if it were another state, will achieve nothing but endless war and more terrorism. Perhaps that is even what the terrorists want. Maybe it's what both sides want. It has strengthened Al-Qaeda, as we heard from Abdel Bari Atwan, who was here in Brisbane this week. They now have franchises, as he describes them, in many countries, including European and Asian ones. This week, too, Colin Powell has warned us of what he calls the terror industrial complex. But faced with the choice between getting long, getting large, and getting out of Iraq and Afghanistan too, President Bush has ducked his responsibility and gone for smaller and longer. Mr. Howard can offer us no solution apart from staying the course. Perhaps that's because Americans haven't told us yet when we could leave. Washington insiders, on the other hand, tell Greg Sheridan, or told him last year, that the alliance is, as he described it, one of the great successes of Bush's foreign policy. So the closeness between Bush and Howard, you see, as variously reported, has brought us all kinds of benefits. One of those, apart from having to go to war in places like Iraq, interoperability and access to various kinds of equipment that's often mentioned, is intelligence. The upgrading, as we were told in September 2005 by Sheridan and Cynthia Bonney, was the upgrading of intelligence access to the highest level. Later we heard it hadn't necessarily happened because of Pentagon resistance. So it was necessary, 2 years later, for Bush and Howard, at the time of Sydney APEC, to sign an agreement for the upgrading of intelligence access, again, to the highest level. Anyway, the value of US intelligence is dubious, I would suggest, if all of it is as wrong as the Baker Hamilton report found in December 2006. What we have to ask ourselves is the value of all this access and intimacy. If Australia is one of fewer and fewer countries on Earth where the current US president is warmly welcomed, as he was in Sydney last month, Australia cannot own its foreign policy and at the same time fulfil Mr. Howard's 2001 pledge to offer all the support that might be requested of us by the US in relation to any action that might be taken. We may claim to be defending liberty against tyrants of our allies' choosing, but we cannot, at the same time, take pride in that if our ally invades countries unlawfully, detains and tortures people, including Australians, in defiance of the Geneva Conventions. Well, unconditional support of an ally based on personal friendship now identifies Australia with the disastrous policies of Bush's doomed administration. How that will advance our national interests with a new president, nobody yet knows. Certainly, it risks making enemies that Australia doesn't need for us, like China and Iran. Relatedly, Australians realised in September 2007 something that the Howard government has been doing in their name at the UN, opposing the draft Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People and persuading Canada to join us. Most Australians know about our isolated stance with the United States against ratifying the Kyoto Protocol, but many are surprised to learn what else has been going on. There is a long list of our other activities in defiance of majority world opinion, and it includes opposing various measures on the rights of the child, on the elimination of discrimination against women, on torture, refugees, Indigenous people, racial discrimination, and cultural products, and even on development and the right to food. Australia has withdrawn from the International Fund for Agricultural Development. And last year, Australia joined tiny minorities resisting the demands in the General Assembly to the end of the economic blockade of Cuba, to the attack on Lebanon, and the wall in the Palestinian territories. Interestingly, while all this was going on, Australia ratified the International Convention Against Corruption in December 2003, at the very height of AWB's corrupt payment of kickbacks to Saddam Hussein's government. That convention obliges member states to pursue those officials and business people who are involved in knowingly paying bribes to other governments. And yet no one has ever been charged in Australia yet over the oil for food scandal. AWB has even been allowed to deduct the kickbacks it paid from its tax. We have, it's true, contributed to tsunami relief, to the Asian financial crisis, and to the reconstruction of East Timor. Australia has recently supported moves in opposition to cluster bombs and has increased our ODA, although not yet to the target level set by the Millennium Development Goals. But given our record of rejecting multilateralism for over a decade, it's not surprising that Australia has, for a decade, been unelectable to the Security Council. The Howard government's unilateralism, you see, that takes the domestic national interest as the basis of foreign policy, imitates that of the current United States administration, but without the United States power. To assert the right preemptively to attack countries in our region that the government suspects of harbouring terrorists is not only as empty a threat as appointing ourselves as the region's deputy sheriff. It is internationally illegitimate. But it would come as a surprise to most of us to know that in a survey in Japan in the last 5 years, Australians themselves were seen to be militaristic, more so than the Japanese. In May this year, Australia ranked only 25th among countries rated for their peacefulness by the Global Peace Index, well behind the top five countries, Norway, New Zealand, Denmark, Ireland, and Japan. The US was 96th. In May, Australia fell to 35th place in the Reporters Without Borders Index of press freedom, and Amnesty International the same month criticised Australia's role in the war on terror, on human rights, and in representing asylum seekers as potential terrorists. Mr. Howard, in that report, was lumped together with Presidents Bush, Mugabe, and Omar al-Bashir of Sudan as cowards who rule by fear. In its first report card on Australia in June, the UN Association of Australia gave Australia no A's, some B's for UN economic, social and peacekeeping efforts, and then the rest, C's and D's for our efforts on disarmament, development aid, refugees and climate change. Australia, the report card concluded, had failed each of the three aspirations of the UN Charter that rejects the use of force, supports global development, and promotes human rights. Australia appeared, as it did in the Global Peace Index that I just mentioned, as a nation that endorses nuclear terror, as they put it, and relies inappropriately on the nuclear protection of the United States. In other words, Australia supports militarism. Now, from our colonial outset, and I'm going to wind up here, Australia has had a strong military streak to its character. With the tide of events, that has surfaced and disappeared and surfaced again. But in the past decade, I think Australia has increasingly resorted to militaristic solutions, not only for problems in our region and far away, but even for domestic problems. Send in the troops has been the government's repeated response, first to maritime surveillance, or even before that, perhaps to trouble on the wharf. First, anyway, to maritime surveillance, then to deterring and detaining refugees, and recently, to problems in indigenous communities. In a militaristic over-anticipation of protests during APEC, the head of the New South Wales Police Riot Squad expressed, quote, absolutely no doubt that minority groups will engage in a level of violence not previously experienced in Sydney. They didn't. But still, police, intelligence, and military people took the opportunity to show what they could do to shut down a city and to practice controlling crowds by fear. Sydney, that was wide open to the Olympics in 2000, had declared zones for a week. How does taking away my rights and freedoms protect my rights and freedoms? Asked one placard. While we might join the chaser in having a bit of a laugh at all of that, declared zones of one kind or another are a short step to something much nastier. They are now a reality for at least 5 years on Aboriginal land in the Northern Territory, and they are indefinitely imposed on military bases and on parts of our coastline. So another question that voters perhaps might like to ask themselves before the election is whether a militaristic Australia is one that makes it safer, or if it's safer only for some of us, and then who, and from what?
Covered a lot of ground in her book, and I certainly can't do justice to all the themes she touched on in 15 minutes. Gerard Ann's writing instructions to me were to basically look at Alison's treatment of the US alliance, so I'm going to confine my comments now to the US alliance, but I'm very happy to engage in debate on some of the issues Alison has raised in her presentation. I thought I should just begin by pointing out I'm not actually here to defend or criticise the Howard government or its foreign policies at all. I'm here, I think it's a more useful discussion to talk about the virtues or the deficits of the long-standing alliance relationship we've had with the United States, which Alison covers to quite a degree in her book and makes some very interesting comments. So I'm going to, as I said, confine my own sort of 15 minutes to the US alliance and perhaps just give you a slightly different view of the alliance than Alison has given you. And by way of context, I thought I might just make a few opening comments about why countries have alliances in the first place and what criteria we should use in making judgments about the efficacy of this particular alliance. I think that would be a useful starting point. I also think it's worth saying that, in my view, it's perfectly reasonable to be critical of a particular aspect of our alliance relationship with the United States, or of a foreign policy decision by the US government, or the Australian government for that matter, and still be supportive of the alliance. So I think they're not that. Let's separate the two issues there. Now, if you look historically, countries have alliances for three basic reasons. The first is a hedge or an insurance policy against the predations of other countries, enemies, putative enemies or real enemies. That's the first reason. Secondly, alliances are used to influence other states, either your alliance partner or your putative adversaries. And third, and increasingly commonly these days, is that you may align yourself with another country to meet common threats, not all of which, of course, are state-based, as we can see increasingly in today's world. Some of them come from non-state actors like terrorist groups, and some of them are from other transnational forces. Infectious diseases, drug trafficking, these sorts of issues that represent threats to all countries. So they're the three basic reasons we have an alliance. And can I suggest to you that the reason that we have an alliance with the United States is no different from the reasons most countries have alliances. It's not exceptional in that sense. Now, the question Alison posed is, does this alliance that we have with the United States actually increase our security, or does it, in fact, diminish our security? And that's a very reasonable question to ask. And I think that's something we should be asking of the US alliance, since we've had this alliance with the United States for 56 years. That is when the ANZUS Treaty was signed, as you most of you will recall, back in 1951. Now, that was a completely different era. The strategic circumstances at that time, in 51, were quite different to those of today. So let's not forget that the alliance that was created in 1951 is not the same as the one that exists today in a number of important respects. First of all, the ANZUS alliance was essentially established to prevent Japan from once again threatening Australia. The thinking in Canberra was that if we allied ourselves with the world's greatest power at the time, it would be the best way of ensuring we did not see another world war because of Japan's basically aggressive intent in the region. Now, that is not the reason why, obviously, we have an alliance relationship with the United States today. So I think the key point here is that the relationship that Alison's referred to in her book has changed enormously and broadened substantially since 1951. So it is not synonymous with ANZUS, as many people seem to think. It encompasses a whole range of activities in the political and strategic domain that go well beyond the purposes of the ANZUS alliance. So when we're talking about the alliance, we're talking about that broader set of relationships, not just the ANZUS treaty itself. Now, let me answer my question. What criteria should we use to judge the efficacy and the value of this alliance? Now, Alison, I think, suggested in the book, if I'm not misquoting Alison, that we've probably been a bit too emotional in making our assessments of the United States, and that we risk becoming supplicants rather than equal partners in that relationship. Now, that's a reasonable position to posit. But what I would say is that when we make calculations about the value of the US alliance, the only one criteria that matters to me is hard, cold calculations of national interest. What's in it for Australia? I would never argue that we should have an alliance with another country just because we happen to like the people. That's not the reason why we have alliances. We have alliances because we think it's in our national interest. And in this particular case, because it enhances our security rather than diminishes it. My position is that it does still enhance our security rather than diminish it, and I'll give you the reasons why. These arguments have been bandied about for 50 years now, so I'm just going to summarise them in four key points. These are the arguments that governments of all political persuasions have made in Australia in favour of a continuation of the US alliance. The first is that having an alliance with the world's only superpower is in net terms beneficial to our security. Why is that? Because allying ourselves with a larger power like the United States is a deterrent to potential adversaries. It doesn't guarantee that the US is going to defend us in all circumstances, and clearly that has not been the case historically. But it certainly complicates war planning for any hostile adversaries. If you're thinking of attacking Australia and you think that by doing so you might risk bringing in the world's largest military power, you probably will think twice about doing that. It certainly would be a deterrent to me if I was thinking about doing that. So I'd say at that level it has been effective in acting as a deterrent, and Australia has gained benefit from that. Now, the counter argument to that is, well, it also might increase our insecurity because it makes us more of a target, and Alison, I think, has argued that point, and others have done so too, particularly in an age of international terrorism. Now, I would agree with the argument that we probably have become more of a target to the Al-Qaedas of the world because we are a strategic partner of the United States. But I would say that the marginal increase in insecurity because of that is outweighed by the benefits that the alliance brings. In other words, we are already a target for the Al-Qaedas of this world. Maybe we're more of a target by a factor of 5 or 10%, But certainly it's pretty demonstrable that countries that have not aligned themselves with the United States have been attacked by the Al-Qaedas of this world and by other terrorist groups. So it does not make us invulnerable to other countries attacking us. So even if you can see that it does increase our vulnerability to attack by Al-Qaeda, I think it's on the margins. It's not really in a major way increasing our vulnerability or our insecurity. The second point is that we actually haven't gained greater influence over the US by virtue of our strategic partnership with the US. Now, clearly every country wants to influence in some way to the benefit of your nation, the major powers of this world, and the United States included. You can't influence the United States unless you have access to their key policy makers, the people who shape their policies. So the first thing is, do we have access in Washington that is above and beyond what we would have if we weren't in an alliance relationship? And my answer is, yes, we do. We clearly do have privileged access in Washington. Now, it's not just Alan DuPont who thinks that's the case. Let me just quote to you Michael Green, who was recently the former special assistant to President Bush and senior advisor of Asian Affairs to the US National Security Council, who has only just left that position about 18 months ago. Writing a couple of weeks ago, Michael said, and I quote him, "Australia has established a level of access and influence in Washington that is greater than any other middle power. I saw this clearly in the White House when dealing with issues ranging from the International Atomic Energy Board of Governors meetings to Iraq, UN reforms and many other issues." Now that's the judgment of a person who was right at the heart of US policy in the White House and in the National Security Council. That is the view shared by many of American congressmen, political figures and academics who I talk to in the United States. It's very common for them to say to me, it is amazing how much influence you Australians have in Washington. There's probably only one other country that's comparable in size to us that has that level of influence, which is probably Israel, and Israel only in respect of the Middle East, where Australia's interest is much more across the board. So I would submit to you that the closeness of our relationship with the United States in terms of access and influence to this particular administration is above anything we would have been able to accrue if we had not had that relationship, that strategic alliance with the United States. Now, what other examples can I give you? Well, Michael Green and others have said over the course of the last few years that the Howard government, I'm not saying this because it's only the Howard government, because the Labor governments have also had very good access at times in Washington as well. But if we are talking about the Howard government, I think it's reasonable to say, to point out that the Howard government has had significant influence in shaping US policy in Asia in terms of gaining US support for the multilateral security arrangements and architecture that's grown up in this region. It played some role in helping the US to change tack on North Korea and get the six-party talks up and running, which have been looked like they're going to be successful. And let's not forget that the US was supportive of Australia's intervention in East Timor in 1999. That would not have happened without Indonesian opposition if the US had not weighed in on behalf of Australia. So there's some examples where I think the alliance has paid off for Australia in terms of our own interests. Third point I want to make is this hoary old question about privileged access to US intelligence. Now, many people have made the judgment that having access to US intelligence is actually a negative because it's distorting our own assessments. And there are a number of cases where that probably has happened. I'm quite prepared to concede that, and Iraq is a classic example. We probably followed too much the US in terms of making our own judgments about the situation in Iraq, particularly in respect of weapons of mass destruction. And all that really tells us is that US intelligence is not omniscient. It doesn't tell us that it's useless. Okay? we have to make some judgments about US intelligence versus other countries' intelligence and Iran without access to the US. Now, let's not forget that every other country in the world got it wrong in Iraq too, including the French and notably the Russians. The Russians didn't clearly have privileged access to US intelligence, but they got the call wrong in Iraq. So the point I'm making to you is it's not easy for intelligence communities to get the judgments right when countries like Iraq, the Iraqs of this world, are trying to cover up and hide their activities. So if we want to make a judgment about the value of US intelligence, we need to look at it across a long period of time in a range of areas. Now, my own judgment is, having worked in the intelligence community in earlier life and having looked at the academic literature on this in some detail, is that the US, by global standards, has one of the most, one of the most competent intelligence services in terms of analytical and collection agencies. It's not without its faults, and often those faults are on the assessment side. But in terms of collection of raw material, which Australia does have access to a far greater degree than most other countries, Australia does benefit tremendously in having advantages over other comparable countries like ourselves. And certainly, if we were trying to replicate that level of intelligence qualitatively and quantitatively, we would be spending billions of dollars more than we are on defence and intelligence. So my own judgment there is that we do benefit from that intelligence relationship. And as an analyst, as an academic analyst, my argument would be I want to see the information. I want to see all the data that I can get my hands on. I don't buy the argument that it's going to distort my view of a particular issue. I'd rather have all the data out there and I'll make my own independent judgments about what that actually means. And I think the Australian intelligence community is perfectly capable of making independent judgments. Just because it has access to US intelligence doesn't mean to say it's de facto going to be distorted because of that access. The fourth point, and the final point I want to make is on the issue of whether or not buying American in the defence and science field, particularly in defence, distorts the structure of our defence force and leads to us having a defence force which is actually more supportive of US policy than our own. Now that's an argument that's been made, and again there is some validity for that. There is no doubt that in the past the Australian Defence Force probably has bought certain items of equipment that probably, objectively speaking, did not really fit our own strategic circumstances. I think there have been a number of occasions when that's happened, and I'm quite happy to concede that point. But again, if you look at it across the board, the Australian Defence Department has a pretty rigorous process for assessing the appropriateness and the value of defence equipment bought from the US and everywhere else for that matter. It has to match our own strategic doctrine and appreciations, and generally it does, and demonstrably so. So I don't think it's fair to say that we just gone out and bought American stuff because we're an alliance partner, when in fact it doesn't benefit us, it benefits the Americans more. I would be very happy to have a longer debate about that and persuade you that it's not the case. I just make a couple more points about this before I conclude. We do buy a lot of defence equipment from other countries, and substantial equipment. Only a month ago, we bought two large amphibious ships from Spain. Now, if you buy the argument that we're only going to buy American and that's really distorting our force structure, then if you look at the equipment, ranges of equipment that we have in our defence force, you'll see a lot of European equipment there. Why? Because it's very good, and often it's cheaper. So cost does come into this. So when you look at all those factors, you look at the way defence buys equipment, you will see, I think, quite clearly in 90% of cases that there is a compelling Australian argument for having that equipment, not that we're buying it for reasons of the American alliance. So let me just conclude very, very briefly. Notwithstanding the failings of particular policies and the undoubted costs that are associated with the alliance, I think the benefits are overwhelmingly in our interest, whichever way you look at it, in each of those four categories. There are costs, but I think it's basically a blue chip insurance policy for us in terms of our security. I think we do need to regularly revisit this subject and keep assessing it, but I think in 2007, as in 1951, the US Alliance does serve us well. That's not to say there shouldn't be improvements and changes to it. I'm very happy to talk about that subject perhaps in another forum. I don't think we've got enough time now. So I think we can continue to have a robust alliance relationship with the United States without being a supplicant. I do not think we are a supplicant, and I certainly wouldn't be supportive of a policy that made us one. Thank you very much.
Alistair, if you come up. So we go to questions and discussion. Firstly, I should say thanks to CAWS for providing this great facility tonight. And so we go to questions and discussion. Jennifer, I've got some copies of Novador Addicted down the back. So if I could just direct your question to one or the other, I'll start off by asking Nelson. If you came back in a couple of years' time and if Kevin Rudd was Prime Minister, would you still be criticising what you've termed tonight a militaristic Australia? Because, as you know, on Iraq, Labour would withdraw the combat forces out of the south of Iraq and leave the security detachment of the fighting force in Baghdad, would leave the Navy in the Persian Gulf, which is a fighting force, would leave the Air Force working in the Iraqi theatre, would want to train the Iraqi army, but probably in Jordan rather than Iraq, and might well increase Australian forces in Afghanistan, because Kevin Rudd said that he would do that previously, before the recent increase of the Howard government. So, if that all that scenario came true, would you still be saying that Australia was militaristic? And if that's not the case, what should a Rudd Labor government be doing?
Yes, certainly. I think that any government that sees military means as the correct way to deal with terrorism, it doesn't matter to me what side of politics they come from. If they persist in that, then clearly they are militaristic. The point about Iraq, well, let's face it, we've just learned today, as many as 700,000 civilians have died because it's the wrong war in the wrong place, has to be deplored. And it can't be continued with by any government that we are responsible for. I don't mind which side of politics that government comes from, and I'd much rather see a government that is winding down our commitment than one that is saying they will stay the course forever and ever until the United States says it's time to go home. I think we should at least, clearly what Kevin Rudd is seeking to do is to downgrade it, just as the Americans are trying to downgrade theirs, by the way, and will as soon as they've got the oil legislation through and a couple of other things that they want. But this militarism on our part and the idea that you can resolve situations like Iraq, which had nothing to do with terrorism, by military means seems to me to be so absurd that the sooner we desist from it, the better.
Richard.
Yeah. Question to Alan. First to comment, Alan, well, it really is a question too. I was at a conference up at Hayman Island the other day, and Tom Schelling, Emeritus Professor at Harvard University and a leading American expert on international relations, said that he was very distressed at the fact that, in his view and to his knowledge, the CIA didn't have a clue about who in Iran might have their finger on a nuclear trigger, if in fact there was a nuclear weapon there to have a finger on. They didn't know what they read, what they thought, what their philosophy was, or anything. And after that meeting at Hayman Island, Tom was going to go off himself and talk to his colleagues in Iran and see what they could find out. And he was also going to try and ginger up the CIA. Is that a sign of a competent intelligence organisation? Second, what do you make of Australia's alliance with the United States in the context of a possible war between Taiwan and China, and Greg Sheridan's famous friend Richie Armitage saying that Australia should have their boots on the ground with us? Isn't this not every Australian politician's worst nightmare?
Okay, on the Iranian question, I think it's generally accepted within the CIA itself that one of their weakest areas is Iran. No question of that. And the Israelis probably have far better intelligence on Iran than the Americans do. And one of the reasons for that is that countries like Iran, it's extremely difficult to collect effective intelligence because it's a hard target. You know, it's not amenable to the sorts of technical capacities that the US excels at, their satellite imagery and their signals intelligence capabilities. So you really have to do it on the ground with covert intelligence if you want to be effective, and the US is not geared up for that. It doesn't have the people with the language skills, the culture skills, and so on. Now, why is that? The reason is because the whole US intelligence structure, up until probably, say 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, was focused on other challenges and threats. It's a global power. So it's got the needs of a lot of people being expert in a lot of areas. And as you well know, during the Cold War, of course, most of the effort went on the former Soviet Union and on various, you know, states like China, where these days they have quite good capacity. But they neglected the Middle East and countries like Iran and Iraq, for that matter, completely. So that's acknowledged as a weakness. And as I said, you've got to make a judgment about the efficacy of their system or their services across the board. If you're asking about Iran, I accept that fact. They are trying to improve it, obviously, but they've got a long way to go, no question of that. Now, on Taiwan, Rick Armitage's comments were not well received in Australia at the official level, and actually weren't supported by a lot of his colleagues in Washington for a couple of reasons. One is, it's not for the Americans to tell us what our policy should be on Taiwan. And we don't go around telling them and fingering them and telling them what they should be doing. So I think Rick Armitage made a mistake in the way he conveyed that message. Secondly, I don't think he realised how much thinking in Canberra has changed. That is, the days when we would be all the way with the Americans and be supportive of US positions in Taiwan have passed. We now have actually a more independent, nuanced policy on that, which is that we are very reluctant to be drawn into any crisis between the United States and China over Taiwan, because China's become a major trading partner, and it's not an easy choice for us now between China and the United States as it was 20 years ago. So the bottom line is that Australia is going to look very closely at the circumstances of any future Taiwan crisis and make judgments, as it should as an independent country, about what is the Australian national interest there. And it's unfortunate Richard Armitage made those comments in that way, because it did create the impression, you know, that we were sort of expected to toe a US line, when in fact we are a sovereign country and we make those decisions ourselves. That's a perfectly sustainable position for a country within a broad alliance. If you think about the Europeans, they have a very robust relationship with the United States. They have an alliance relationship with the US, but they're not afraid to criticise the US and to give a European view about what the US should be doing. And that's the position I have in terms of our alliance. And I think most of the time we do that. Not all the time, that's true.
Okay,
this is a
question here. I think that interview was with Peter Hodges.
Which one?
The Armitage interview.
Well, Sheridan was close to the delivery this one.
I think it was Peter Hodges. It's a question here. Yeah.
Alan, I'd just like to see what you think about an alliance, the value of an alliance made with a country that has repeatedly said that they will only act in their own best interests, and have shown that in World War II as an example. But what is the value of an alliance with somebody who says we'll just act in our own best interests regardless?
Well, I think that's a perfectly reasonable basis for having a relationship. If I can just give you a business analogy, okay? If you and I are in business together, why am I going to be in business with you? Because we have shared values, because I like you? Probably because I think I can make money with you, okay? I'm going to be acting out of self-interest, just as I assume you do. Now, if our self-interests coincide and they're common, that's the basis for a relationship, a business relationship, okay? Now, why shouldn't that be the case between states, that the US can act in its own interest, as we do, but where those interests coincide, as I think they do in many, many areas of the alliance, that's why we have it, then that makes perfect sense to me. But I don't see that as being, as those two issues being mutually opposed. But you obviously do.
I do.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough.
Alison?
Perhaps I can give you the answer you're looking for. It might be a little bit different from Alan's point of view. And that is that not just Rich Armitage, but many other Americans over many, many years have said exactly what you just said. That is that America will not go to war, and in fact explicitly in the Guam Doctrine, President Nixon said that America would not go to war in the Asia-Pacific area unless it was in defense of America's interests, and that did not necessarily include Australia, even if Australia was under attack. And that has been said by people again and again and again. And until we get it, we continue, as I've said, to expect the US alliance to do for us what they have clearly told us it will not do. And yet we do for it what we ought not to do. So Mr. Howard said that by reinterpreting the alliance, now Alan says that the alliance has broadened. Nevertheless, he talked about the printed words on the page in 2001. He said, I have reinterpreted the alliance and I have, implicitly, I have made it possible now for Australia to go anywhere that the United States asks us to do to fight against anybody at all. Now by doing that, that made the alliance an unequal one because the United States didn't change its position. And unequal treaties are bad treaties. I don't, by the way, advocate, if some people think I do not advocate abrogating the US alliance. I don't advocate abrogating any alliance. Alliances are solemnly entered into and carefully thought out by people who put a lot of effort into them, and they ought to be honoured, but they ought to be equal. And interpreting an alliance in a way that obliges us to do things that our ally will not do, and we expect the ally to do things that it will not do, is not an equal treaty, and we need whoever is in government to have another very close look at reinterpreting it back to what it actually says.
Alan wants to make a brief comment.
Sorry, can I just say one other thing? I just don't want you to think I'm a kind of cold-blooded person, completely, you know, sort of just strategic. I should have mentioned the fact that, you know, when you're making judgments about having an alliance relationship with another country, which is a qualitatively different relationship to just having a bilateral, you know, relationship of some kind, it's because you have common values, presumably, or a high degree of common values in terms of there's an identification between your countries at the societal level that you stand for roughly the same things. Now, what I'm saying is that we don't have an alliance with a lot of other countries. We don't have an alliance with North Korea, for example. Now, why is that? So it's a judgment about national interests, but also common values as well. Now, the US, for all its faults, okay, is still one of the most liberal countries in the world. It's an open democracy. The biggest critics of US foreign policy are Americans. So there are a lot in common we have with the United States. If we didn't share those common values, then it would be much harder to sustain the argument we should have an alliance relationship. So I thought I'd just add that.
There's a question for you. We're going to be quick.
Dr. DuPont. You mentioned Israel, I think, in the context of Israel having perhaps more influence in Washington than Australia.
On certain issues.
On certain issues. Okay. Well, it's not for certain issues. I'm going to just raise a question. It seems to me that the Palestinian-Israeli problem is one of the root causes of the continuing strife in the Middle East. Accept that as a given point. My question is, do you believe our alliance with USA is sufficiently strong for us to say to USA, look, hang on, chaps, what you're doing in Palestine, especially on the West Bank, and what you did in southern Lebanon is just not acceptable to us, and unless you do something that is much more balanced than our alliance really is at risk? And would the United States take any notice of us?
Well, to start off with your last point, would the US take any notice of us? Now, that's an important comment you've made, because what we have to assess is when we're actually seeking to shape US policy, we've got to be aware of our own limitations and strengths. Now, the US, frankly, would be less likely to listen to us on Central America or probably the Palestinian question than it would be on Indonesia or Asian issues. And the reason is that we have obviously a more direct interest in our own region. We have more expertise there, and that's recognised by the US. So we do have to make a judgement about, we might feel all kinds of things about US policy in various parts of the world, but you've got to work out, are we going to have any impact? So that's the first thing. Now, let's assume that we thought that we could have an impact on the Palestinian question, US policy. Do I think we should be saying something to the Americans? Yes, I do, obviously. Has the Howard government done that? Now, they would argue they have. Others would say they haven't, all right? Now, this is a judgment, this is a personal, you know. So if Alexander Downer was up here, he would be saying, we have made these representations to those governments, but we prefer to do it through quiet diplomacy, all right? Others will criticise the government and say, you haven't said anything, you just count out the Americans, you've not actually stated an Australian position. Now, I mean, I know Alison's position on this, that the Howard government has not gone out robustly representing an Australian view on a lot of these questions. I think in some areas I would agree with her, but not to the extent that she argues in her book.
Okay.
Alison, you suggested that since 1860, I think it was, when the Bismarck attacked somebody, I'm not quite sure who, 1870, there hadn't been a successful invasion. I'd like to put to you that East Timor, yes, was reversed, but the Irian Jaya was invaded, and both of those with the support of Australian Labor governments, and Irian Jaya has not been reversed.
Okay, it all depends on what's an independent country and what's not, doesn't it? Both East Timor and Irian Jaya had, let's say, difficult status at that time, contested status. I'm talking about the invasion of a sovereign, separate country, not the invasion over the separation of a territory, okay? If we're going to get into historical detail, that's the difference I would make. But there are, in fact, a couple of other possible exceptions, because I thought carefully before I blew that one by you tonight. In fact, I took Bob O'Neill's advice on it this afternoon. And he said, well, of course, this century there have been a couple, and didn't say what, so I thought. And I thought of different ones from you. I thought of Panama, and I thought of the Falklands. So, although the Falklands, again, it's a contested status thing with the Argentine. By the way, can I just say, when I'm thinking of Argentina and Alan's remarks about buying cheap military stuff or expensive military stuff and so on, it's interesting to note that we bought an Argentinian nuclear reactor to put it with Lucas Heights, and the thing's been out of commission for 3 months.
I'm a bit confused about this. Italy was invaded in the Second War.
I would have thought Italy was invaded.
Successfully.
Well, I thought it was pretty successful. They knocked off Mussolini. Italy was invaded. Germany was invaded. Vichy. France was invaded. But they were invaded. Otherwise, Mr. Mussolini would still be there.
And the invader won is the implication. And the invader did not, in the end, win.
Well, Mussolini is not there anymore. I mean, I was in Italy recently, he's not there. He was hanging upside down in the Milan Square.
It's a nice plane took over Germany and gave it back.
I don't know where Bob O'Neill's been. I don't know if he speaks to me. I thought the Allies had invaded Germany.
Both of your speakers didn't mention economics and globalization. Now, the development between the US and China, for instance, as well as the development of the relationship between Australia and China, how would this influence our association with the US or alliance with the US, if it has any influence at all?
Alan might want to say something more about that, and I'll just be very quick. Clearly, that's why Alan quite correctly says, and I say, that this would be one of the biggest tests of Australian, the independence, if we had it, of Australian foreign policy, if there were to be a contestation between the United States and China. If only because, and there are other reasons, but if only because China is now our biggest trading partner. In other words, we've got a huge amount invested in China. China has a huge amount invested in us, as well as in the United States. We are held hostage, in a sense, by the Chinese. And he's quite right to say we can't let that thing get out of control. It's impossible for us to do so. And certainly, it would be absolute suicide for Australia to follow Richard Armitage's assertion that we had better be with them or we'd be against them over Taiwan. But the fact still remains that the United States and we and the Japanese have a different foreign policy towards China from what we say. We are, in fact, doing a kind of encirclement, certainly from the way the Chinese see it, and we're now trying to get India to hop onto that too. So we talk with one voice when we're not talking alliance, and we talk another one when we're talking alliance. And this is one of the reasons why I think it's the way we're behaving is so lacking in independence.
Brief comment, yeah. Then we go down the back of the side.
All right, well, just my brief comment would be, I made the point about what brings the US and Australia together is shared interests and shared values. That plays out in the international economic scene as well, in the sense that both the US and Australia are supportive of an international trading regime that has actually been largely responsible for the advances that virtually all countries have made over the last 50 years economically. So we have clear economic interests there. We also have a very strong bilateral trading relationship, but where it works against the alliance, I think, is the point I made before, that as other countries in the region become closer economic partners with us, it makes it a little bit harder for us to, you know, we don't want to be in a position of having to choose between countries, and it's becoming more difficult now in respect of China and so on. So there's two opposing trends there, but overall, I think the economic dimension is an important part of the glue that binds us with the United States because of our commitment to a free trading system.
Final question off the back. Yep.
Alison, just a question for you. You talked about the rising militarism in Australia. Do you think there's an appetite for that in the average public? And how deep do you think the average public's understanding of defence and security issues is?
I don't really know who the average public is, but I can just go by the sort of trends that I see government being re-elected for. I mean, they've been... The defence budget has doubled since, the defence spend has doubled since 1996. Now, that may just be because of rising costs, but I suspect not. I think it's because there's been a deliberate effort to position Australia to undertake global so-called defence tasks anywhere. And, of course, that means go anywhere at the behest of the United States, it's quite clear. So, as long as Australian electors go on approving that, then I can only think that they think that kind of militarism around the world is a good thing for Australia to be associated with. And the interesting thing about that, about perceptions of, you know, what a nation is and so on, is that the New Zealanders don't behave in that way, and none of our neighbours in this region felt so threatened by Saddam Hussein that they felt it necessary to send troops to invade his country. So why did Australia? Why just Australia? Well, I think it's because we do have these two strands, if you like, in our national character. One is the one that says, oh, for God's sake, you know, let's all get on with each other and treat each other decently, indeed generously. And the other says, we are really afraid of things that we don't know about that might come and bite us. And the thing that's going to make us feel more secure about that is being tough and upfront and standing up to them and doing whatever it takes, et cetera, et cetera, as long as we're doing it with someone bigger than us. And that's why in my book I describe us as the fag sucking up to the bully in the school.
know there are many more people who want to make a contribution, including Stan, but...
I just want to ask, on that basis, I mean, just generally, yeah. Academically, on that basis, yeah. What you just said, Alison, should we have gone to war in 1909? We could have all got on with one another and stayed down here with
the war...
No,
but there are a lot of people who thought we shouldn't. I don't, and I think, actually, what? The Second World War. Of all the wars that Australians have been involved in, and there are 17, of all those wars, we were only defending Australia once, and that was in the Pacific part of the Second World War.
And the war for Germany, not the Pacific, in 1999.
Yes, I know.
And you're saying we shouldn't have.
I'm saying I don't think we should have.
Okay. I just want that answer.
Because I think that it. In every case, in that case we went to war because Britain, what we were doing in those cases and what we're doing now is behaving like a colonial dependency. The purpose of a colonial dependency is to send raw materials to the metropolitan power and send its men to fight in the metropolitan power's wars. And we did that with Britain right up to the Second World War, and ever since then we've been doing it in that case.
This is the loudest enunciation I've heard of Australia's commitment against Hitler in many times.
So we
should have followed the United States and been neutral until 1941. That would have been colonial. Anyway, look, it's been a lively discussion, folks. And all good fun. Now, Alison, Anne, just behave yourself. Alison's book, Allied and Addicted, which is a good read and a quick read, I think, which is good about these books. You can read them more quickly, and everyone's very busy these days. So Janet Grundy's got some copies down the back. It's a mere 127 pages, and there's a lot in it. And so many thanks to Alison Bronowski for the talk tonight, and to Alan DuPont, because we've had a great debate. We could have gone all night, and I think it would have been lively, but it would have been long, and it's 7 o'clock, so I'd just like to say thanks to both our speakers. Both your papers will be published in the Sydney papers, both will be up on the podcast, and I'm sure they'll both be back in the future. They've both been here before, and I'm sure we'll see them again. So many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.